welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And look at us, we're both here.
You can't look at us, we're invisible.
Oh, that's right. I always forget that for all of you dear listeners, we are these invisible little voices in your head.
I mean, women should be heard and not seen. All I'm looking at right now is an esophagus full of coffee.
Mm-hmm. Yes, delicious coffee that is going to work its way through my bowel system.
Meanwhile, I'm drinking like a pea green morning smoothie. Imagine how gross that would look if I were invisible.
Just imagine like a couple of like a brown esophagus with a green esophagus just chatting away at each other.
Why would it be brown?
Well, because no, mine is brown.
Oh, yours is brown. Okay. I think our lungs are brown.
Yeah.
A lot of play to be had with the concept of invisibility, and that's exactly where we're going today.
And as a reminder, this was a request. What we did is a few months ago, we put a poll on our Patreon so that all of our patrons could vote and pick and see what all of you wanted and make it all very democratic. And the people spoke, and the decision was to complete this trilogy of mad science and strange science and what the fuck science.
It's a trilogy of mad science, but also, you know, just kind of a throwback to what we did last month, which was looking at an original and a remake. And I think we'll agree that the original and the remake of The Fly were vastly different, but really analogous to the different eras in which they came out. And, you know, I think that's the conclusion we'll probably arrive at yet again. The distance between the two films we're talking about here is vast. But, you know, there's a lot of space to play, and we're going to talk about all of that.
So I think we should start with the father of science fiction, one Mr. H.G. Wells, an iconic author who is, of course, not appreciated in his time. He wrote War of the Worlds. He wrote The Time Machine, and of course, The Invisible Man. And today we are talking about the 1933 version of The Invisible Man and the 2020 version. Now, for myself, I actually had a bit of time and I got to read H.G. Wells' book. And it adheres pretty closely to the structure of the 1933 film. But I will say there is so much more interiority in the novel, which I think is just, that's part of, you know, the, you know, in film you want to show, don't tell.
Right.
In books, you got to tell, don't show, pretty much, unless you're doing something like House of Leaves. But in this novel, you really get a sense that this doctor is succumbing to madness at being isolated and being different from everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not my favorite thing I ever read. There are some great like passages and chapters in it and then stuff where it kind of lost me. And I went kind of back and forth with it, but it is a short read. And if you are interested, I do recommend it.
Mm-hmm. I didn't get a chance to check it out, but I do have a couple of notes here that I was able to glean from the web about the differences between the book and the film, which hews pretty close to the source material. Except, we're going to get into the film in a second, but I did struggle a little bit with sympathy and empathy for the invisible man, for Griffin. I was able to gather that Griffin was an albino man, a former med student who left medicine to devote himself to optics technology, and motivated primarily by the desire to do something that's never been done, which is a pretty classic mad science trope, as we've been talking about for the last several episodes. But I think, you know, the idea that he was visibly othered adds kind of an interesting dimension to the story.
Yeah, and I think this is something we're going to talk about in the two films and, you know, chat about now. But there is such an interesting tension in all of these narratives about what happens when your invisibility makes you the most sought after person.
Mm-hmm.
They make, you know, everyone's just kind of wild about the invisible men and has a lot of fear and anxiety, but also interest. And there's so much going on when you can't see this body versus what happens when you are othered either by, you know, genetics, society, cultures, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So like the way we look at the individual versus the way we look at the masses, I think is always kind of at play within these stories.
That's right. And I think even invisibility as a concept, like we talk about women being an invisible demographic in policy and stuff, just because they are not seen, they are not recognized, they are not heard, they are not included in these debates, often debates on matters that concern them directly. There's the book Invisible Man from 1952 by Ralph Ellison, where an unnamed Black narrator reflects on his social invisibility throughout his life. There's a nonfiction book that refers to invisibility The Invisible Woman by Claire Tomalin, which is the bio about Charles Dickens's super underage mistress and muse that he like hid away in a cottage until he died. Like, invisibility can mean a lot of different things.
Yeah. And I think the way that invisibility is gendered and structured culturally is so important. You know, when we talk about the invisibility of Black men or, mm-hmm. you know, Black communities, that's a really different thing than what it is in these narratives to be an invisible white man mm-hmm. and who is still wielding power, who is still wielding authority and oftentimes gaining power and authority through this invisibility. Mm-hmm. And the way, you know, there is this anxiety about how women are seen. You know, we've talked so much in this podcast about the film theory of the male gaze, which is that women are to be looked at. And what happens when a woman tries to escape the gaze mm-hmm. of a camera, of a man, of anything else?
Mm-hmm. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. Let us start with James Whale's film, the 1933 adaptation of H.G. Wells' The Invisible Man.
Right up to the top of his head, all round his ears.
Flora's worried about Griffin.
I had a terrible feeling last night. I felt he was in desperate trouble.
He meddled in things men should leave alone.
Not the slightest clue.
That's where the clues are. He wasn't leaving anything to chance.
There must be a way back. God, he knows there's a way back.
What are you doing? Help!
Only they leave me alone.
It's the stranger with the goggles. He's gone mad.
You're crazy to know who I am, aren't you? All right, I'll show you.
Let me into your madness when you're peering through the keyholes and peeping through the curtains. And now you'll suffer for it.
But why? Why do it, Griffin?
Just a scientific experiment at first. To do something no other men in the world had done. Suddenly I realized the power I held. The power to rule. To make the world grovel at my feet.
You know who the Invisible Man is, Doctor. Where is Dr. Griffin?
What's the good of concealing it?
Oh, come and stay with us. Let's fight this thing out together.
Police, quickly. The Invisible Man is in my house. He's mad. He's killed a man tonight.
Believe me, as surely as the moon will set and the sun will rise, I shall kill you tomorrow night.
The secret of invisibility lies there in my books. Don't you see what it means? Power. Power to walk into the gold vaults of the nations, into the secrets of kings, into the holy of holies. To run squealing in terror at the touch of my little invisible finger. Even the moon's frightened of me. The whole world's frightened to death.
I'll lay traps that even an invisible man can't pass.
He's near stations now. Watch the wall.
Help! Help! He's here! He's here!
Here we go, gathering nuts and may on a cold and frosty morning.
While conducting a series of experiments, Dr. Jack Griffin accidentally renders himself invisible. He flees to the countryside in hopes of continuing to work to find a cure. However, the townspeople become suspicious, and when confronted, Griffin reveals himself to be invisible as he removes his clothes and makes a run for it. Griffin goes to his colleague Kemp to team up for world domination, and they start by returning to the village to retrieve Griffin's notebooks. They hear the police dismissing the sightings of an invisible man as hysteria. Enraged, Griffin kills the police officer, and Kemp becomes increasingly scared and asks their other colleague, Cranley, for help. Cranley's daughter, Flora, who is also Griffin's fiancée, overhears the conversation and goes to see Griffin. Griffin softens when he sees her, but becomes angry when he realizes Kemp has deceived him, saying he will kill Kemp the next night at 10 p.m. In the meantime, Griffin goes on a killing spree. The police attempt to use Kemp as bait, but Griffin outsmarts them and kills Kemp. The police are eventually able to track Griffin after it snows and they can see his footsteps. The police fatally wound Griffin, and as he dies in a hospital bed, his features begin to reappear.
And he turns out to be pretty cute.
Yeah, Claude Rains. What a hottie.
He's kind of a babe.
Yeah.
This one was a first-time watch for me, and I was struck by a lot of things off the bat. I was struck by the comedy mm-hmm. elements, and the comedy elements are introduced very early on with the landlady and the barkeep and, you know, her personality and her hysteria and her grandiose facial expressions. And immediately I was like, oh, this is going to get really scary if it needs this comedy levity this early on. But the comedy really doesn't let up.
Yeah, it's a very kind of over the top film. And I had, when I was really, you know, in my 20s, being like, horror's really going to be my thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not fucking around anymore. I sat down and I watched all of these Universal monster films. And I always remember there being this kind of chaotic energy to this film, which I think is very much part of James Whale's oeuvre.
I agree.
Yeah. And it's this kind of like the invisible man in this film, like Griffin kind of feels like a troll because like when he creates chaos, it's, you know, you're seeing this stuff on film, in the camera. It looks incredible even to this day. It's so effective. It's so funny. And like all of the, you know, quote unquote killing spree he goes on, we don't see a lot of like the violence and the after effects of violence. Mm-hmm. We are in the moment of this kind of madcap journey he's on.
Mm-hmm. And I was also really, really struck by how well it holds up, the special effects, the practical effects. They really don't wimp out. Anything that you could possibly be curious about what the invisible man might do, like what happens when he eats? Is he naked? Like, what if he wants to smoke? What if he this? What if he that? We get to see all of that, and it just never cuts away. Relentless realism, super fun. However, this film is not without its foibles. I mean, I consider them kind of foibles. Can we talk first of all about Flora?
Absolutely.
I felt like Flora's presence at the beginning of the film being like, so worried about my missing fiance and he disappeared and he hasn't even called. And father and his father like does not give a fuck about basically anything throughout this whole film.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of really enjoyed how he was this very detached man of science, which I think we might kind of come back to later. But having done the Quatermass experiment, mm-hmm. having done the Frankenstein films, I thought more would come of their romance. But whew. That's a cold subject in this film.
Yeah, she felt way more like a plot device mm-hmm. rather than something I was engaged with. Mm-hmm. Like someone had to insert heteronormativity into the film.
Right.
And, you know, to keep it going, to make it make sense, to show that heteronormative love is good and true and can actually soften the monster.
Uh-huh.
And like little like Beauty and the Beast-esque. But yeah, it's so brief.
Yeah,
which I think kind of speaks to Whale's own queerness and wanting to queer narratives.
Uh-huh.
And so I like to read it like that.
Yeah,
but I
yeah.
think when you're just sitting down to watch a film and if you don't have all that extra context, it feels very shoehorned in.
Mm-hmm.
And it does take you out of the action and the narrative to just kind of stop and be like, don't forget, he stuck it in her.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes him soften towards her.
I feel like that heteronormativity kind of rears its head again later when Kemp is kind of hitting on Flora, which again, I thought was going to deepen some kind of love triangle. Perhaps that was going to be a particular point of resentment between Griffin and Kemp, but it never really comes back to that. And I mean, that's fine. It's just to say I had a hard time connecting emotionally to this film, certainly by contrast to the next one that we're going to talk about.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if we're talking about the foibles of this film, and of course it's a classic, there's so much to like about it. But as this film was made in 1933, they are developing all this technology and trickery to make this invisible man come to life in many different ways and keep it interesting. This film is leaning into spectacle.
Yes.
It is reveling in the spectacle. It is nailing the spectacle mm-hmm. and then kind of being like, oh shit. Yeah. We've got to kind of tell part of this story.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to, you know, still make sure that gets across. So I think that is, you know, something that they don't quite land on. Mm-hmm. They never find that balance. But I'm okay because I enjoy watching Griffin being this like delightful over the top troll who's like throwing money around, who's, you know, in each scene, Whale is finding different ways to make this invisible man visible.
Mm-hmm.
You see it through like the clothes, the unwrapping of bandages, as you mentioned, the smoking, the running away with the bike. Like each scene, it feels like they're doing something different.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it is this anxiety about who is this man? And where is he? And then how are we going to meet him next?
Yeah. I also have in my notes that the original Griffin from the H.G. Wells novel was driven deranged by his situation, whereas there is a conspicuous note in the film that this Griffin, his insanity, his homicidal impulses, his madness are a side effect of the drug. And again, is like that kind of feels like a ham-fisted way to try to engender sympathy. But the more I think about Griffin and the more I think about my inability to connect with him on an emotional level is just because within the universal canon of monsters, so many of these monsters are born monsters and are therefore deeply sympathetic. You know, like Dracula, for the monster that he is, he needs blood to survive. The Wolfman is what is. Frankenstein was created a monster, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas Invisible Man kind of stands alone in that he's a human being and a deeply sociopathic one, a deeply privileged, egocentric one. And that's really terrifying.
Yeah, you're not quite sure where you stand with him. Mm-hmm. And as the madness kind of ratchets up, it goes from like fucking with a bar to derailing a train, mm-hmm. and just like murdering hundreds of people.
Yeah.
I saw a stat when I was researching just in general of the kind of universal monsters that the Invisible Man by far has the highest body count.
No kidding.
Yeah. If you think of the other universal monsters, they're not necessarily setting out to like massacre people and like world domination. They mm-hmm. want to survive, or they want a bit more power, or they want to be left alone.
Or they can't help it.
Or they can't help it. Yeah. And here you have someone who is like driven mad. Again, that's an important point. The book is, you know, this descent into madness as he becomes more isolated from the world. Whereas in the film, they mention this part of the experiment, this drug that's introduced that is known to drive people mad. And in this, you've got someone who's just like off the walls and you don't know what he's going to do next. And mm-hmm. therefore this world, this society, the communities he's oscillating between become deeply destabilized.
Yeah. And that instability, I think, was a large part of what H.G. Wells was hoping to impart, specifically economic instability. At the time that Wells wrote the book, science wasn't highly regarded in British culture. And so he posits Griffin as a social outcast in the book. And Wells himself wasn't super embraced by literary circles in his time, as Alex already mentioned. And I found a great article called The Invisible Man and the Invisible Hand, H.G. Wells' Critique of Capitalism by Paul Cantor. And I will link that in the show notes. And he notes that Wells may be regarded as one of the architects of the welfare state. He really hoped that the 20th century would be the century for socialism. He's like, things are going fucked up, they're going sideways, and we don't know how to react. And so the result is this story of a megalomaniacal scientist who kind of represents the instability of the shift toward rampant capitalism that was ramping up at the time. And specifically, I wanted to draw attention to Cantor's use of invisibility as a theme that came up in good old Adam Smith, way back in the day, Mr. Free Economy, Mr. Pro-Capitalism. I took sociology and he still came up in my classes, even though he's just economics guy. So his assertions that, quote, in an unfettered market economy, an invisible hand guides the self-seeking actions of individual entrepreneurs for the good of the community as a whole. So basically, if you've got boomer parents like me, if you've got a boomer of an economist father like me, you have heard this kind of rhetoric lectured at you again and again and again, that in a free market economy, the cream rises to the top. Everyone has a chance to succeed. It's a total equal playing field. And then the idea that there is an invisible hand making sure all of that is being dealt with fairly. I think we can all agree that that invisible hand is money and privilege, and it's crazy. And so, you know, we've got Griffin representing invisibility as a form of chaos in society, rather than Smith using an invisible hand as a sense of order, which I thought was a really interesting observation.
One of the things that really jumped out to me, especially in the film, is the needing to go back and forth between spaces and yes. how the village becomes its own like mass hysterical, anxiety-ridden place because of Griffin. He comes in there and he disrupts the people. He murders some of them. He fucks with the bar. He fucks with the income of the people running the inn. He's like messing with their lives. And in doing so, like the more distinct Griffin becomes because of his power, because of his invisibility, because of his madness, the more that this kind of mass of townspeople seem to bleed together and they become this kind of one entity. And, you know, if we think about H.G. Wells writing in the Victorian era and the Victorian era being a beneficiary of the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. I think it speaks a lot to this kind of economic growth that the British Empire was having. And so many people, like, basically, had the Industrial Revolution not happened, Britain's empire would not have spread to the extent that it did. And for anyone who needs a quick refresher, the Industrial Revolution was a technological boom in manufacturing from 1760 to 1820 or 1840, depending on who you talk to. And basically that means that goods and products could be reproduced en masse very quickly. And it pretty much upended multiple systems of the economy and really changed the way we live. And we're still dealing with those after effects now. And in H.G. Wells, as Andrea was already mentioning, with like the invisible hand and these kind of growth of economy and how everything was changing, here we see a very clear distinction of certain very powerful people mm-hmm. who we don't see, many of whom we don't even know, foreseeing certain things to happen through their privilege, through their access, through everything else, while we have this very visible metaphor in the people of this town being driven crazy, being told that they are crazy, being told that they are crazy by the police mm-hmm. until Griffin makes himself known.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Industrial Revolution, and if we look at this through the lens of like a Marxist conflict theory, and, you know, the emergence of the socioeconomic class system as being directly linked with having the means of production and like, I have the means to make money, therefore I make money, and the emergence of this new class of the bourgeoisie, you know, insofar as Griffin was a social outcast because scientists weren't so highly regarded as they are now, we know that he comes from the city. He is able to secure a lot of money due to his power. You know, he's able to rob people and have access to whatever he wants. And I think it's so fascinating that the rural setting, we never get to see him in London. Yeah. I think the book describes that it was too busy for him there. He was being jostled in the crowds. Being invisible was hard in the big city. So he goes to this rural setting where he just wants to be left alone. And insofar as the villagers are very suspicious of him, they are willing to leave him alone as long as he pays. And the trouble only comes when he runs out of money. And that's kind of where, you know, the work I'm doing doesn't matter. My magical powers don't matter. Unless I can pay, there's going to be conflict and I'm ready to spill blood. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of points to the ruthlessness, I think, of the bourgeoisie is kind of what I'm getting at here.
Yeah. And I think like, and I don't have a good answer for this question, but I'll introduce it and we can all have a think about it. But, you know, when he becomes invisible, I feel like this narrative allows us to question how he transgresses. And then how we as a society have made these boundaries in which to transgress against, you know, like what are those, you know, we've talked about this before on the podcast. You've made many, many excellent points about it. Like we all kind of collectively decided that we would trade goods and services for this like paper money or now this thing that I tap my card against. And, you know, this is how the world functions and we've all agreed to it. And then you have someone who has power to a certain degree, but also is invisible. Mm-hmm. So he can move between spaces unnoticed. And then it becomes like, oh, why did we decide this? How are we beholden to it? Why are we beholden to it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's really interesting to consider Griffin's invisibility as it relates to his social status. Because it's like, on the one hand, society denies it to him, dismissing his scientific contribution. And as a result, he hoards it. He chokes it down. He doesn't share it. He just, I mean, it's driving him crazy and ruining his life, mind you. But but then on the other hand, like he actively refuses it. He revels in his literal invisibility and anonymity to commit an antisocial act, to commit all these crimes. So yeah, I thought that was cool.
Yeah. I think through all this conversation, what strikes me the most is that Griffin is this emblem of power that one man can hold and can wield through almost by accident. Mm-hmm. Like so many of these, frankly, they're almost all men and they're almost all white and able-bodied, et cetera, et cetera.
Universal monsters, you mean, or in the film?
In like capitalism.
Oh, in life.
Yeah. the real life monsters.
Damn it.
Who, you know, control us. That this power whether it's through science or politics, is a marking of what could happen when you achieve too much and it all goes bad, or you act only in your own self-interest and you begin to ignore everyone else around you. You know, to the point when he's even, you know, he almost forgets Flora. Again, we've talked about how minimized Flora is in this narrative and, you know, whatever that means. But it's like, oh, I am so high on my own supply that I forgot about my fiance.
I forgot about her. Whoopsie. I read so many assessments of this film as like, she brought him back to Earth. She brought him back to himself. And I was like, I read his scenes with her as manipulating her, as trying to get an ally, having burnt Kemp. And yeah. Yeah. No romance to be found.
But through this power, he becomes less human. He's, you know, trying to avoid all the things that we as humans need, like eating, drinking, smoking. So he's not visible, as we talked about, because those things show up on the interior on screen, which is really fun. But he's trying to avoid that. So he's essentially kind of dehumanizing himself. And in doing so, creates this much wider gap between himself and everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great way to think about Wells and this, you know, warning he had about the power that people were amassing versus the masses themselves.
Well, before we fast forward all the way to our next film, which is a 2020 film, there has been some invisibility in cinema in the interim that I want to maybe just like touch on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'd like to start perhaps with mention of a 1940 Invisible Woman film. I didn't get to check it out, so I just have the briefest of synopsis here that it involves an out-of-work department store model who becomes a test subject for an invisibility device. It works, and then she uses her ability to get revenge on her former boss. And this like little synopsis really tickled me because, of course, you know, I'm always thinking about gender. I'm always thinking about like when it comes to men with power and privilege getting this ability of invisibility and how they would wield it. How would a woman, like women who experience visibility and invisibility on such a different scale? The result is this film that is a bit more of a comedy. Her condition wears off, and then she discovers that alcohol consumption restores it, and hilarity ensues. I read that it was considered risque because of the fact that the heroine, although invisible, is naked during much of the action. Not a big deal in James Whale's film, but invisible cock is less of a big deal than invisible titties.
Well, now I'm just rethinking why we record the podcast in the nude. Should we put clothes on?
No.
Okay, good. I just like my boobs flapping in the still air.
Me too. Dustin loves it.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen that either, but now I really want to. And I really now want to update my LinkedIn profile to out of work department store model because... Mwah. So, and then skipping ahead to the early 1990s, and this was a film I remembered from my childhood and was like, oh, I've not seen it in years. And then I tried to rewatch it and remembered why. And that is Memoirs of an Invisible Man from 1992, directed by John Carpenter, starring Chevy Chase, about a guy who accidentally becomes invisible. And then the government and some kind of seedy agency, which is led by Sam Neill, is chasing him down. And meanwhile, he just wants to go on a date with the beautiful Daryl Hannah. And this one, I, to be really honest, I was watching it just for like, you know, extra credit, and I didn't finish it.
Okay.
I paid money to rent it. And I was like, I don't want to finish this. But what I will say, what struck me on this one is that Chevy Chase's character, and this film is based on a French novel, but Chevy Chase's character is just a good guy.
Aww.
He's just a good man who's kind of aloof in his life. And then he meets this like bombshell who's like wants to fuck him on sight.
Of course he does. He's a nice guy.
And then, whoa, no, he's invisible. And it's just this good guy moving through it. So like the conflict of it, it feels more gaggy and gimmicky and less like, oh, I want to see what happens next. It's just like, how is he going to be a good guy again?
Neat.
You know, it wasn't for me.
Okay.
The next one, which I was like, oh, I need to revisit this in full. I watched the whole thing, of course, because that is Paul Verhoeven's film from the year 2000, Hollow Man.
Now, This came up in my research as well. And I was like, okay, Hollow Man, I remember seeing ads for that. That's Kevin Bacon, right? Okay. And then I check out the Wikipedia and the first thing I see is Paul Verhoeven. And I'm like, uh-oh, this one got past me. I need to see this. And then I saw a bit of the synopsis and I was like, wow, this is taking this invisibility concept to some dark, deep places.
No one does problematic, watchable smut like Paul Verhoeven. And I hadn't seen this one in a really, really long time. And it was one of those ones, as I started to rewatch it, I was like, and then this happens and this happens and this happens. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. It's like kind of icky. It's kind of weird, but I found super watchable and I actually had a really good time with it. Okay. I think you should watch it, Andrea.
I think, for sure.
Because it is like, it's taking like, what does an invisible man do with power and kind of sexual frustration and anger and lust? And how does he affect the other people who he's working with? Because, you know, the science, it is a team. So how do they all work together? How does that function? How do they sneak around? How do they show this to the government? So there is like, it is a really interesting, I think, adaptation of The Invisible Man. And mm-hmm. Verhoeven was like, I basically wanted to make an Invisible Man movie. Maybe it had something to do with the rights or who was holding the property at the time and other plans for it. So he didn't do that, but he made his own kind of Dollarama version of it.
Okay. Yeah. And it's like a hard R horror film, right?
Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, I would say definitely if you're going to watch it and you haven't seen it before, like maybe just like read some of the synopsis because I put some content warnings on some of this. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And then there's some stuff which if and when you read about it got taken out of the film, but you can still find those scenes on YouTube. Yeah. And then finally, one Invisible Man film that is so invisible, it never got made. I'd like to take us back to the year 2017 when Tom Cruise tipped his hat towards making his own cinematic universe. This was when like Marvel was really coming into like the height of their powers, when people realized the Marvel Cinematic Universe was its own thing. And so Universal developed something with Cruise and with some other filmmakers and other people called The Dark Universe. So Tom Cruise stars in the 2017 film The Mummy, which,
not to be confused with the Brendan Fraser one, which is flawless.
Perfect. No notes. But this one was another big, like, modern day action adventure film. Tom Cruise is this kind of like, I don't know, guy. He's running around stealing stuff. He comes into contact with the mummy who is unearthed. Russell Crowe plays Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, who is kind of like at the center of this universe that they're building. And the film, I also tried to rewatch this for the episode, and I also got about halfway through it. It to me was so boring. It was just, ugh. It was like 20 minutes of plot, 20 minute action sequence, 20 minutes of plot, 20 minutes of action sequence. And I was like, I have a life to live. Ugh. And that life to live was taking photos of my cats, uh-huh. but I still wanted to do that. Yeah. In any event, in the lead up into the promotion of The Mummy release, they were like, we are doing this dark universe. So let's showcase the other actors who are going to be involved with it mm-hmm. in a really like glossy photo shoot with famous celebrity photographer, Annie Leibovitz. And so the other people involved in this photo shoot beyond Cruise and Russell Crowe were Javier Bardem, who I believe was going to play Frankenstein's monster.
Okay.
Which I actually think is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. I really like Javier Bardem. And then Johnny Depp as the Invisible Man.
Wah, wah, wah.
Yeah. Which, given the next film we're going to talk about, is like, you may as well have cast Johnny Depp. Quite frankly, not that far off.
But I love the idea of a super expensive, super elevated photo shoot for something that hasn't happened yet. Like, that remains as an artifact of this hubristic idea of, it worked for Marvel. How could this go wrong?
And it went wrong because they made a boring, bad movie that did not make enough money to yield the other films that they were going to build upon it.
Yep.
But there are enough interesting artifacts on the internet. You can go back, you can look at them, see the interviews, the hype of them. And then I found something very interesting because I was like looking up this photo. I wanted to double check it, make sure I hadn't imagined it. And I found it. And then I was reading a few articles, just remembering that like wild time. And oh God, I love reveling in the stupid hubris of Hollywood. And I found an article. It was just summarizing everything. And they had the photograph in the article. But in this version, Johnny Depp was photoshopped out.
Well, he was invisible.
Clearly. sense his troubles. He's just gone method.
I think that is fascinating. And I think that's actually the delicious irony of the invisible man becoming invisible, the delicious irony of doctoring an old image, you know, kind of trying to convince us as, no, we weren't going to do that. See, it wasn't in the image. Maybe we'll talk about that a little more in a minute, but that is a delicious factoid. I'd like to make one more mention of an invisible person who doesn't appear quite in horror cinema at all. I'm thinking of Sue Storm, one of Marvel's Fantastic Four, which was inspired by Universal's Invisible Man. She has invisibility and some kind of force field ability as well. Apologies, I'm not an expert. The concept of her being naked to be invisible was too spicy for a comic book in 1964, so they made it so that she can be invisible with her clothes on. Anyway, Sue Storm, I read, did not get her first solo series, as popular as Fantastic Four is and was, as old and as classic to the Marvel canon as they are. She didn't get her first solo series until 2019, and it was written by one Mark Waid. And I decided to read a review of it and see what it's about and see what it's like. And I found this website called womenwriteaboutcomics.com. I'm sure there's listeners out there who are shaking their head and being like, oh yeah, 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 that. But this article written by Kate Tansky, really, it was so well written that I like looked her up on Twitter and really hoped against hope that she's also a horror fan so I could get her in Rumorg, because it was such a great article. I'll drop it in the show notes. And she notes that like this book is just so steeped in the male gaze, and not just in the writing, it's a comic book. So it just in the way she's depicted visually and the way she's drawn literally. I have a quote here from the article. I titled this review, "The Evidence of Things Not Seen," because what is not seen is always as significant as what is seen. And in this comic, that's both visual and narrative significance. And I thought that was just brilliant. Anyway. Sue Storm fans, you have yet to get your due. But as we talk about how filmmakers, artists, creatives have tackled invisibility, invisible men, invisible women, invisible nice guys, invisible maniacs, it all brings us to a 2020 film that was a pretty big hit within the horror genre, a pretty big hit outside the horror genre, that hit the right notes at just the right time. And I'm talking about Lee Whannell's 2020 Invisible Man.
So many people have been asking us to do this on the show, so I'm really glad we're finally getting to it. And another notable thing about this version of The Invisible Man is it's one of the last films to come out before the pandemic.
That's right.
Some people got to experience it in theaters, but it was also one of those films, along with The Hunt, that was released very, very quickly on VOD. And it became this kind of bomb as we were all like, trying to stay home as much as possible and figuring out what the hell was going on. At least we had a couple new movies to watch. And I remember just sitting there and like watching it and feeling really moved and, you know, having a lot of thoughts and feelings about this film. And some of them have changed on this rewatch. I have some more questions. I'm ultimately glad it was made. I'm glad we're talking about it. And I'm excited to talk about it because I am just crazy to know what you think of this film.
Oh, you know, I do remember really looking forward to it. I didn't get to see it in the theater. So it was one of those things that under lockdown, when it dropped on VOD, it felt like such a treat. And I remember really, really enjoying it. On the rewatch, some of the seams showed. And the more I think about it, I have some critiques, but I think it's a singular film and definitely a discussion-worthy one. So let's jump into it. Lee Whannell's 2020, The Invisible Man.
Adrian. He was a sociopath. He said that I could never leave him. He controlled how I looked and what I wore. Then it was controlling when I left the house and eventually what I thought. I'm sorry, I can't take you with me. I'm not gonna leave you with that thing on. What happened to him?
Adrian's dead.
Listen, you're getting your freedom back, okay?
He said that wherever I went, he would find me. Walk right up to me, and I wouldn't be able to see him.
Adrian is dead.
He's not dead. He has figured out a way to be invisible. He's sitting in that chair.
With Celia sneaking out of her high-tech, isolated Oceanside home in the middle of the night. We learn that she's fleeing her abusive tech mogul boyfriend, Adrian, who she's drugged with her own diazepam. Assisted in her escape by her sister, Emily, and staying with her friend, James, and his teen daughter, Sydney, Celia is struggling to adjust to her freedom until she learns that Adrian has apparently committed suicide and left her a hefty sum. She uses the money to thank James and Sydney and attempts to restart her career as an architect, but she feels Adrian's presence everywhere, watching her and seemingly sabotaging her every move. When she finds the prescription bottle she used to drug him, she becomes convinced that he's faked his death to fuck with her life, but nobody believes her. She finds a high-tech invisibility suit in her former home, but before she can tell anyone, Adrian murders her sister in public and puts the knife in Celia's hand, setting her up for the murder. Now institutionalized, Celia learns that she's pregnant, and Adrian's brother offers her freedom in exchange for returning to Adrian so they can raise the baby together. She refuses and is able to shoot the invisible man as it attacks Sydney, but surprise, it's revealed that Tom, not Adrian, is wearing the suit. Adrian is then found tied up in his home, effectively setting up his brother for his own murder spree. Celia agrees to meet Adrian to discuss their future together, but she uses his own technology against him and slits his fucking throat.
Like a boss.
Like a boss. And you know, there are fist-pumpy moments in this film. I remember the twists and turns about Adrian and Tom to be deeply satisfying, and I felt that way on the rewatch as well.
I mean, also, I think the restaurant scene.
Yeah.
Like, because Adrian ratchets up his gaslighting of Celia pretty intensely and pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So it goes from like, oh, I'm going to fuck with the stove and make it seem like Celia is like very forgetful or not like on top of things to straight up murdering her sister in public.
Yeah, right in front of her face. It's brutal. And, you know, like, I mean, the special effects, when we talk about modern special effects and invisibility, it's done very well.
Yeah.
I really enjoy the way the film is shot. I thought it threw back to some of the scariest elements of Whale's Invisible Man, which is, for me, when Kemp was in the house and like we've ascertained that Griffin is a threat and Kemp is just looking over his shoulder, a lot of wide shots of empty space, and you effectively feel someone watching you. It's a very unsettling feeling. That comes through in this film as well.
It's a very clearly realized version of what horror can do best, which is the camera is not privy to the unseen or threatening force. Mm-hmm. It's always lingering off camera. It's doing something. It's about to jump out at characters when it's too late for them to do anything about it. Think of any horror film, you're going to think of an example of that. And in this film, we really see that because in most other genres, when we think about the camera, when we think about the generalized non-gendered gaze of the camera, if there can be such a thing, it's omniscient. It's just showing us what's in front of us, unless it's doing something like a POV shot or something really specific. classified like that. But in this film, we don't know where Adrian is. And Wanell is not interested in kind of doing all the gimmicks and stuff like that, that Whale was doing and showing off the iconography, the wrapping, the floating cigarette. Mm-hmm. Here, it's we really don't get a sense of Adrian until the very end of the film, mm-hmm. and what the suit is and how it's working and what the whole conceit is about.
That's right. And, you know, plausibility of that technology be damned. We can relate to the archetype of the toxic boyfriend. We can relate to the archetype of the tech bro CEO who feels like the rules don't apply to him. And, you know, it's a heightened sense of privilege. But I think what really elevates this film among its ilk, I think what makes it especially noteworthy are the themes of abuse and trauma in the era of Me Too.
So let's talk about what this film is born out of. Mm-hmm. For me, it kind of traces back to 2016 with the Donald Trump Access Hollywood tape. Don't worry, we're not going to play any clips from that because hopefully you all know what we're talking about and you remember how disgusting it was.
Yep.
And I remember, Andrea, so clearly, like, seeing that story break, and I was going to a cottage with friends, mm-hmm. and we were sitting around being like, this is it. He's done.
He blew it. He blew it. There's no way he'll be president now. We have nothing to worry about.
Yeah, he's not coming back from this. No one will allow it. People will revolt. And then he was elected. Yeah. And I think that was really psychically traumatizing.
Absolutely. My faith in democracy was demoralized. Like, my faith in everything. Everything I knew to be true and possible.
And we're not American.
And we're not even American.
It was so upsetting. And then you fast forward to the next year in 2017. And Andrea, do you remember where you were when you heard about the inciting event of Me Too?
I do. It was a moment that we shared together, which are my favorite moments.
So this is the first time Andrea and I were doing Salem Horror Fest, and we decided to take a couple days in Boston mm-hmm. first. And I remember before we left on that trip, hearing that something was going to break about Harvey Weinstein.
Yep.
I knew he was a bully. I knew he was awful. There was a lot of shady stuff that I thought it was going to be a business thing, or like, I didn't know what it was. And then I remember, I'm pretty sure we were on our way back from dinner, and looking at Twitter and the story breaking. And it was, you know, that Harvey Weinstein is a serial sexual abuser and it has been going on for decades. It has affected so many actresses. So many of them have had their careers affected. They've been blacklisted from Hollywood because of him. But I remember sitting in this cab and you and I were talking about it and just being like, this feels different. This feels like something is going to change.
Yeah.
Not everything has changed,
yeah.
Not enough. It hasn't gone far enough, but we've had a lot more conversations about it.
Yeah. Weinstein's in prison. Trump is hopefully going.
Yeah. And a lot of survivors of abuse have been able to come forward and tell their stories. It's never easy, but we've been able to identify patterns of abuse, serial abusers, and start to dismantle the system. And it's never going to be enough. We will never be able to do enough, but it is the beginning of dismantling this. That is the important part.
That's right. And I'm glad that you brought up The Hunt as well, because I remember thinking that that film was also tackling something very relevant and very emergent that was unspoken, which was the radicalizing of the far right and
yes.
the far left. And to see that depicted as the polar opposites that they are in such a playful, violent, weird way. I felt like as far as satire goes, it gave and took in equal measure, and I quite enjoyed it. And then I felt like The Invisible Man was an example of a new kind of storytelling with this Me Too awareness, with this language of trauma entering the common vernacular. And that was really exciting to me at the time when I watched it the first time. One of the things that struck me on the rewatch was that the Me Too elements felt a little thin. They felt a little shoehorned in. And that is something that is supported by the fact that I read that Elizabeth Moss, who plays Celia in the film, you know, having just cut her teeth and hit it really big with A Handmaid's Tale, which again was like a very dark satirical.
Well, and Mad Men before that.
Yeah. But I think my point is that like she played, I'm not going to say a feminist role, but like just this edgy feminist satire that was kind of saying this might happen.
Sure,
and
yeah.
certainly the way things were going at the time and the way things have gone since with regard to women's reproductive rights and Trump's reign.
And I also just want to stop a few more emails that Peggy Olson was also a feminist icon in Mad Men, and just no one needs to email
us. I'm so sorry. I didn't watch the show.
It's fine. It's fine. But just like no one needs to email us about Mad Men. Okay. I'm just stopping the emails.
You think it'll happen?
Listen, people will email us about all kinds of shit.
True. So Elizabeth Moss apparently advised on the script, and it stands to reason that the reasons why some of the Me Too elements were maybe a little thin was because this was probably fundamentally a horror action movie. It was about the torments and ordeals of an abused woman, yes, but I think the gaslighty elements were probably amplified by her. Probably. I'm speculating here. But I think the film still has this really male gaze. It feels like a toy soldier action movie, you know, with like, particularly I'm thinking about that scene in The Institution where the Invisible Man has this like heavily choreographed combat scene with all these, you know, guards, more guards, send more paramedics. And they're just piling up on the floor. Some of them are blasted in the head and others are just smashed against the wall. And like, there's a lot of that. And there's a lot of traditional horror set pieces. And then there's, oh, gaslighting and believability and trauma and abuse and all of that. And it got me thinking that this movie is kind of, it's mouthing the words of Me Too. It's emulating that language without quite nailing the landing. And it's something that actually, I was thinking about that with regard to a new headline that I saw about Jonah Hill. Have you heard about this?
I have.
So Jonah Hill, if you haven't heard, his ex-girlfriend, Sarah Brady, is a surf instructor who recently shared his abusive texts to her that shamed her for posting photos of herself in a swimsuit. Did I mention she's a surf instructor? Anyway, the reason I bring this up is because his texts, like, in addition to being ghastly, controlling, disgustingly smug, he keeps using the term boundaries, and he keeps using the term boundaryless relationships, and these are my boundaries. And I was like, that is the language of the oppressed that you are co-opting to oppress. You are making your boundaries into a controlling set of rules and essentially an ultimatum for this woman to live under, and that's not what they're supposed to mean. And I think that's just kind of a modern byproduct of things like Me Too. And you hear people use the term triggering incorrectly all the time. You hear people use the term gaslighting incorrectly all the time. And it's really irritating because, you know, this language has to be in its proper context or else it rings hollow.
And I actually agree with you on a lot of that. And I think that was something that struck me because one of the things I forgot when I went to rewatch it is that Celia is pregnant. It's revealed that she's pregnant halfway through the film. And it's like, oh, that narrative part they never close the loop on it.
They don't.
It's like, oh, is she having an abortion or does she feel safe to have this baby because her abusive ex is out of the picture now? Also, how fucked up is that? Because they mention, or Tom mentions, I believe, that Adrian was fucking with her birth control pills that she was taking to prevent getting pregnant because she knew that's what Adrian wanted and she didn't want to bring a child into that situation. And like, that's like a whole fucking movie right there. And then you add in like this kind of narrative button that the way she gets Adrian to reveal himself is she kind of alludes to attempting suicide.
Yeah.
And then it's like bodily autonomy.
Yeah.
Like, I know it's like super, you know, we're all really hot on it since Roe v. Wade got overturned. But like, even then, even back in the salad days of 2020, we were still having anxiety and fear about how people with, you know, ovaries and, you know, our reproductive bits were going to be able to protect our own bodies.
That would have been something to lean into. That was something that was even touched upon to more satisfying effect in the 80s with David Cronenberg's The Fly. We mentioned it. If you're going to use the pregnancy as a plot device, which you may, it's not my favorite plot device, but when it works, it works. You have to close the loop.
Yeah. And like, it's so heady and it's so like, for a lot of people who've been through situations like this, it's really like, ooh, it's like, I'm seeing part of my life on screen. What the fuck? And then to just kind of have it like, and we've just not worried about that anymore. And it just ends. And I think, you know, you can kind of see like Lee Whannell, I was coming off of his film Upgrade.
Yeah.
Super fun, amazing B movie. I think that has kind of like led him on this really interesting career path.
Yeah, I think it showed his ability to portray near impossible tech in a dystopian situation.
Action sequences. Yeah. And like, I think he wanted to have those elements in, and that's cool. Like, that's part of who you are as a filmmaker. It would be like David Cronenberg, like not including weird tools or tech or like the human body being exploited into the machines. Like, it would just be odd if he didn't have it. But I think, Andrea, to your point, as we kind of, you know, like we go away from the Johnny Depp Invisible Man in 2017 to cut to 2019 and Universal saying, oh, we just want to do these standalone monster movies. And, you know, leaning into this Me Too-ness of it, you know, it does feel like they're puzzle pieces that kind of fit together, but they're not the perfect ones. You just kind of jam them together a little bit.
It was so close. And if you're listening to this and thinking, oh, well, I really resonated with those themes and I really liked that about it. Dude, I did too. I enjoy this movie very much. I just feel like, I don't know. I don't want to say that I wish it was in the hands of a female filmmaker, but I do wish that these stories were told a little more fully. I wish it went a little bit further with it, is all I'm saying.
And Andrea, can I tell you something?
Yes.
It's okay to really enjoy something and also be critical of it.
What?
I know.
No.
I know. We've been doing this for 10 years. I just want to make sure you know that.
Make sure I know that.
Just you.
Okay.
No one has ever, ever had a problem with this except for you. And I just want to make sure you know this.
Got it.
That it's cool and that opinions can change and evolve. Speaking about the way like films evolve and like the way the Invisible Man is invoked in this film, I was recently on our friend Mike Munzer's podcast, The Evolution of Horror, and he's doing a whole home invasion series, which is really fun. And I was on the episode that's just come out. We'll link it in the show notes, where we covered Sleeping with the Enemy and Fear. Mike and I had a really interesting conversation about erotic thrillers and both of these films. And we were talking about how could they be updated for today. And I was like, you know, I think we've got our Sleeping with the Enemy update, and it's The Invisible Man.
Mm.
And this film, The Invisible Man, feels so indebted to Sleeping with the Enemy. For anyone who doesn't know Sleeping with the Enemy, super, super briefly, it's very young Julia Roberts in a very abusive relationship, and she fakes her own death and makes a run for it. And then she winds up in this small town, and she's happy, but her abusive ex is following her. And the film ends with the confrontation between the two. I think the film is like, it's definitely watchable. I think it's most notable because of Julia Roberts. But in watching it, like the opening half hour takes place in this like immaculate mansion that they have that is on the beach. And so much of the house is windows. It's just all of these windows that like look into this couple, and it's just the two of them. And we see moments of abuse happen. We don't see the moments of abuse happen in The Invisible Man, but in Sleeping with the Enemy, we get a taste of it. And to me, it was so reminiscent of like the opening sequence. And then when she goes back to this house and she's surrounded by these windows, and it's like this abuse was happening, but people didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. Adrian is so powerful, is so privileged, has so much wealth that he can openly do these things and no one's going to touch him because he has the tech, he has everything else. And the fact that kind of central to it is that it's not like a potion, it's not an experiment gone wrong. Adrian has developed a specific tech, and I'm sure he did it for the government or something nefarious like that, but it's also, he is able to use it as a tool of abuse so he can follow her, so he can fake his own death and torment her from initially believed to be beyond the grave. But now we know it's like a full, like, it's just a suit he pops on and off. And I think it is such a perfect metaphor for the way these men who were outed through Me Too, being able to go in public, to go to premieres, to walk red carpets, sign autographs, take photos, do whatever. And then the private are fucking monsters. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, like, these people have so many like big teams around them. And it's like, you see as these things get litigated, these other people brought in and be like, yeah, I know about it. Yeah. I've texted about it, but we just weren't going to talk about it. We weren't going to deal with it.
Like, the more I think about a glass house, you know, like we talk about the abstraction of the glass ceiling being the upper limit to limit women's mobility upward. There are glass walls too that limit their mobility to exist.
Yeah.
And that's something that she comes up against. And it's a pretty great one.
And the wealth, it's like, it's all part of this control. It's all part of it. And again, that's alluded to within the film. I don't need that to be much more explained because I think it's pretty self-evident. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can take that away for ourselves. But it is something that I think these two films, Sleeping with the Enemy and The Invisible Man 2020, share a lot of DNA. Mm-hmm. And I think they're much closer in relation than The Invisible Man 2020 is to the 33 version or even the H.G. Wells book. And I'm cool with that. But I like that. I think we should be really willing to reimagine our remakes and be excited about them. Uh-huh. A couple other films that came to mind while watching this version were Gaslight from 1944, which is, of course, where you get the term to gaslight someone. And it's about a husband who keeps dimming the lights in the home and basically makes the wife think that she's going crazy while he's actually doing it to her. The incredible French film, Les Diaboliques, which is also about, you know, kind of, you know, fucking with someone's mind. And then very briefly at the end of the film, when Celia uses the tech against Adrian, I felt very, very strong allusions to Gone Girl.
Yes. I had that nice, good for her.
I know. I was like, oh, this is great.
Surprise. All right. So going back to the original Invisible Man versus this remake, I think it's really interesting to note the differences in plausibility and believability as these films approach that subject. Whereas the original Invisible Man really heightened tensions between the urban genius and the rural panic, impersonal modernity and rural values. When it came to convincing everyone, the Invisible Man wanted to convince everyone. He demonstrated it, and he had to repeat that demonstration again and again, because the first people he demonstrated it to were a bar full of drunks. And the police are like, how many did you have that night? And he just has to reveal himself again and again, which is funny to say for someone who's invisible. And, you know, to that end, Wells was likely aiming his satire at religious faith, superstition, you know, mad science. Nobody understood anything like that. Whale's film makes it satirical and funny, but Wells was likely aiming some satire at religious faith and superstition or something like that. But then we have this remake that focuses on the societal tension between legal plausibility and personal truth. Celia's allegations and concerns aren't valid without evidence, not in the eyes of the law or to even her loved ones. And further, she's an unreliable witness due to being a woman, being a traumatized woman, being a woman for whom diazepam is prescribed, all those things. And so that kind of brought me to thinking about the nature of evidence and specifically empiricism, which is a foundational element of modern society when you think about it. And, you know, one thing that scientific theory and the criminal justice system have in common is that they both rely very strongly on empirical evidence, things we can see, things we can know, whether it's to prove or disprove a theory or to prove or disprove guilt or innocence. But of course, empiricism has its limits. There was once a time when we thought that pictures didn't lie. And now we have deep fakes and really convincing CGI that is challenging that notion. Seeing is believing doesn't hold nearly as much water as it used to. And that's actually a really big problem when so much of our society is grounded on concrete evidence that something can be seen. Now, I read about a study by Elizabeth Loftus, who is one of the pioneering researchers in the field of altered memories, where researchers showed people advertising material for Disneyland that described a visitor shaking hands with Bugs Bunny. But after reading the story, about a third of the participants said, oh yeah, I went to Disneyland. I remember meeting Bugs Bunny, but Bugs Bunny doesn't live in Disneyland. He's a Warner Brothers character. None of those people had met Bugs, but seeing the images of them convinced them. Like, it gave them a memory because it gave them an image. And that ability is something that is genetically inside of us. We are designed to quickly recognize faces, but we're not as good at spotting other details like sketchy reflections or shadows or other telltale signs that images have been manipulated. And I think, you know, even going back to your observations about Johnny Depp disappearing from that photo, it's almost as if Universal hoped that we wouldn't remember, that this picture would convince us that no, we never intended to go with him. We promise.
Yeah, just don't worry about it. Well, and I think the conversation around empiricism is really interesting because ultimately Celia then uses that to her own advantage in the end.
That's right.
And she circumvents the systems. And I had a couple thoughts about the way cops are portrayed within this film.
Ooh.
Again, I think, you know, Lee Whannell is his, he's got his filmmaking style, and I wouldn't say it's subtle. I would not say the filmography of someone who co-wrote Saw is the most subtle, you know, quiet film you've ever seen. Exactly. And I think, you know, when we are in narratives like this, an easy shorthand for authority, for safety, for everything like that is cops. James is a cop. He's a good guy. He's so charming and likable. And he's kind of roped into this scenario as Celia, you know, begins to really lose control of what's happening in front of her. And then there's a really odd moment when it just stuck out to me like a sore thumb. And it's in the restaurant scene as Celia is trying to get Emily, her sister, back on board after they've had a falling out.
She's got evidence and she's ready to spill it and nobody can refute what she's about to say.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here. I love you. You're like a cop, Emily, and you have this brute force strength that is so, so comforting when I'm in trouble, and it is really intimidating when I'm not.
So in this context, we're saying cop is in like, you make me feel safe. Mm-hmm. Andrea, you make me feel safe. I have never once compared you to a cop.
Well, I never thought of shooting you. Well, being at the wrong place at the wrong time.
You never fucking narc on me. but it's like, this is such a weird, like, artifact of early 2020.
It is. It's such a, it places it right in its moment, which is post Me Too, but pre Black Lives Matter.
Yes. So it kind of feels like this very emblematic film of white feminism mm-hmm. in that way. And I think that's why it's like chafing against us.
Yeah, maybe.
A bit. And it's like, oh, this isn't like, this is like cheap moisturizer. It's just on the surface. It hasn't really sunk in yet. And again, like if this means something to you, if these themes resonated with you, that's still cool. It's still valid. But I think this is where we start to see that disconnect happening. And, you know, again, like using, you know, law enforcement as a shorthand for authority and safety is like, if you're in a position movie and you use the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. you know,
I feel safe around this priest.
Yeah. I'm just a child. Don't worry about it.
You know, it's going to date the film, but in a way that's interesting. I enjoy a dated film because, you know, as we do on this podcast, everything has its proper context. And that was a moment. That was a cultural discursive moment where we were having some conversations
yeah.
and not others.
Yeah.
And that's exactly why Black Lives Matter exploded the way it did, when it did, because those conversations needed to be had. In tandem with everything else.
Yeah. It's like I have on my Faculty of Horror notebook. Intersectionality now.
Intersectionality all the time.
All the time.
But since we can't yet time travel, we have movies like this where it's just kind of like, whoops, not yet. We weren't ready for that.
And speaking of time travel, well, kind of. We've mentioned this fella on several episodes.
Are we going back in time?
We're going back in time to...
Going back to the classroom.
Yeah. I mean, I had to mention some theory. And it had been a while since we talked about our buddy, Baudrillard.
Good old Bodhi.
And his theory of simulacra. And this is, of course, from his book, Simulacra and Simulation. And for anyone who needs a quick refresher, simulacra for Baudrillard is an image or a reproduction of someone or something. And often it is an unsatisfactory imitation. This can be anything from like, oh, you see the Mona Lisa in the Louvre and you know that's the original, but you also have a postcard of the Mona Lisa. And is that any less valid than what's in the Louvre? Or like, what does the context of going to Paris and seeing it in the Louvre mean versus seeing it on your fridge?
Right. Because there is a difference, but it's conceptual and it's cultural and it's sociological.
Yeah. And it all kind of speaks into this notion that we're like living in a simulation and like what's actually happening to us. And it got me thinking because, you know, if you want to like pad out a book, you need to have different ways of talking about these ideas and theories. And listen, Baudrillard does a good job. We tease. And so Baudrillard starts talking about degrees of simulacra. And this is generally, you can think of it as periods of time when these theories emerge or when these evolutions of simulacra emerge. So I think for our purposes, I wanted to talk about the second order, which is associated with modernity and the Industrial Revolution and the rise of mass production when copies threaten the authority of the original. Mm-hmm. When we all became a bit more anxious about what's real and what's not. Now, especially with the rise of AI, with deepfakes, with things like that, I think a lot of us, if we're tuned in, are questioning these things a lot more, which leads us down some very strange paths mm-hmm. of paranoia. Now, what we have in this film is the abuse of Celia continues. But it is, in my reading of it, kind of an imitation because Adrian has utilized this tech that renders him invisible. He's able to move through spaces. So Celia has gone from being in this, you know, kind of castle kept away from everyone. Because as she emerges into the world, people are like, I didn't know it was happening. I didn't realize it was this bad, blah, blah, blah. They're all saying these things where they're kind of shocked. They didn't know how awful it was. And so you see the abuse move from the controlled area of Adrian's house out into the world. And this reproduction of abuse is kind of challenging this authorial quality that first Celia has, because then she is not believed. She is unstable. And then as it grows, as we see the slap of James's daughter, Sydney, mm-hmm. by Adrian, but it's blamed on Celia, to Emily's murder, to the fight sequence in the hallway of the mental institution, this kind of imitation is growing more and more unstable. So within this context, within this community, within the society, this need to abuse, this ongoing period of this production of abuse, is destabilizing all of these characters and their environment. And then when Celia decides, like, she wants to entrap Adrian, mm-hmm. she tries to do that. He won't admit to it on audio. So then she goes and she gone girls him, and, you know, we all stand and cheer. But then she kind of resets it.
Yeah.
She inverts the abuse. She then abuses him. She murders him using his own tech back in the house where it started. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, I think you can see how this reproduction of abuse goes too big and it's too crazy. And then she actually gets back hold of it. Mm-hmm. And then she brings it back to where it started, mm-hmm. inverts it and ends it.
Which is delicious. And I think that's a large part of why it's so satisfying, is it all goes back to the original site of everything. I think it's a testament to the film that this is a fairly realistic portrayal of how mm-hmm. abuse and yeah. trauma does ripple and ripple and ripple and continue. And, you know, I think Baudrillard would have dug it.
Nice. No angry emails from his estate.
Yay.
That's the goal of this episode.
Hey, man, we're keeping his books in print the way we mention him again and again.
We fucking do. They should be a sponsor.
Oh. So as we wrap up our discussion of The Invisible Man, The Invisible Men, always men, except always. For the department store model.
Out of work department store model.
Yes. Who gets her revenge. We're going to watch that movie.
Yeah.
Hopefully we like it. Hopefully the Elizabeth Banks directed reboot of The Invisible Woman that was announced back in 2019. Ooh. She was supposed to star, direct, and produce it. But I think we've clearly demonstrated that there is so much to be unpacked in the very idea of invisibility in this narrative that went from, you know, an albino failed med student all the way to a CEO tech bro genius. And, you know, I think there are still a lot of great stories to be told within the context of invisibility being a superpower, whether the invisible person is a hero or a villain. That speaks to modern discourse of technophobia, of like, this technology exists. It depends on who's using it and why.
And I mean, at the end of The Invisible Man 2020, like, Celia has the suit. She's walking off. So in fact, we kind of have a version of the Invisible Woman, but we don't have a sequel. We don't know what's up next.
Ooh, I want it to be her now. And I want her to write it, maybe.
Yeah, but no Scientology edits on it. No. I guess my final question about these films, and that, or that's inspired by these films, I should say. Andrea, if you were invisible, what would you do?
Oh, I would lurk, baby. I would eavesdrop. I'm already a prolific eavesdropper and people watcher. I would want to get into spaces where I know I'm not allowed and confirm my suspicions of what goes on behind closed doors.
I actually totally agree with that. I'm fascinated by what people do behind closed doors and those discussions they have. Mm-hmm. And I think in a very real way, what I would do is, if I was invisible today, I would get on a flight to LA. Mm-hmm. I would go to Sir. Mm-hmm. I would go to TomTom. And they're filming the new season of Vanderpump Rules. And I would just sit there and be like, CCTV 24 hour. I want to watch it all. Yeah. So I think that about does it for us on the topic of these invisible men. Thank you so much for listening. As always, we are taking our August sabbatical. So no main feed episode from us in August. But if you like what you hear and you aren't already on Patreon, please subscribe there. We've got a lot of different tiers. There's a lot of great back catalog stuff on there, a lot of existing episodes. And we're going to try and put out a few things, a few very fun things in August. So hopefully some good stuff to look forward to.
Yeah, we're going to take it easy a bit, but we still do have some homework, both for us and for you, because our September episode isn't that far off, and we have a fun one in mind.
We have a very fun one. We are leaving behind the science fiction, the anxiety, all of that that we've been talking about the last few episodes, and we are going back to the 90s. We are talking erotic, problematic thrillers, and we are discussing single white female.
Adjacent, perhaps. It was in the spate of the 90s kind of psychological thriller, but this film was just so influential. It is referenced all the time. It embodies so many classic horror themes and tropes that emerge again and again, and I'm really stoked to revisit it. It's been a minute.
Yeah, it's a fun one. It's super watchable. It's super weird. Like, let it wash over you.
Yeah, so we're going to ease back into our next semester with that. That is your homework. As usual, fall means a big banger of an October episode that we've already started plotting out. New merch is underway, our class of 2023 merch. I almost said 2022. I can't believe it's 2023. I can't believe we're talking about The Invisible Man having come out so many years ago.
And I know.
It still feels like
practically a classic now.
COVID has erased my memory like the little Men in Black gadget. But until technology wipes us out completely,
office hours are closed.
I'm looking through you. Where did you go? I thought I knew you. What did I know? You don't look different, but you have changed. I thought I knew you. What did I know?